trying to get closer. I don't know.
So I am meeting with Carmen Acevedo Butcher. Is that how you say it? Okay. And we've just spent a couple days together. The Day Ahead for Women, the Women in the Professions and Academy, which is associated with the Well newsletter, and we've found some time to sit down and have a chat, which I'm very excited about because I've gotten to know Carmen a little bit, and I'd like you guys to get to know her a little bit, especially if you didn't get a chance to go to the Day Ahead. So Carmen, I'm going to ask you a few questions. Not sure where the interview will go, but I'm trusting God that it'll go in a good place. So to begin, I should mention that both you and I are in English, and which makes this a very great interview for me to do. And I kind of see you as somebody who's further along than I am. I'm finishing up my PhD, and you're much further along. You've been a professor for several years, and in Georgia. And so I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your journey towards getting to the place where you are now professionally. How did it go? What steps did you take, and what were some of the twists and turns along the way?
Well, I think it was actually mostly twists and turns. When I was a little kid, I used to teach rocks. I remember putting them on steps and actually teaching them. So I always had this notion that teaching was awesome. But I didn't know you could be a college professor. So I didn't have that huge overarching goal. I mostly had the goal of getting to know Jesus better and healing. Yes. Actually, so the course of true love never did run smooth. So I went to graduate school, and the twists and turns start with I wanted to go abroad to learn about other countries. So I applied for a Rotary scholarship because a friend of mine had one, and ended up in Germany. They picked where I went in Germany, and ended up in Heidelberg. So after that year, I came back, and my sister was studying nursing at the University of Georgia, and I decided I wanted to live with Angie because she was sweet. And so that meant I had to support myself in some way. So I was either going to work as a secretary, what we called secretary back then, for the German department, since I could speak German, or I was going to go to graduate school. They had already hired somebody for the German secretary, so I went to graduate school. So I ended up doing a master's degree, and then the professor said, we like having you around. Would you like to stay for a PhD? So I did that at the University of Georgia, and fell in love with teaching because they had a program then where they put you with mentors. That's the thing for me, is always that I've been fortunate in having great mentors. It's one reason that I hope to have exchanges with people younger than I am, not that they can't teach me something, but I always have found that there's a great exchange intergenerationally and such. A professor, one of my mentors, suggested I apply for a Fulbright. I'd never heard of a Fulbright, but I did, and found myself at University College London. And there I met my husband. And that's a whole other story unto itself. But at the time I met my husband, I was working on my PhD, or it was working on me. You know, they say you never quite recover from a good PhD program. You don't get it, it gets you. And I was working on my PhD when I met my husband. We dated for 3 months, were engaged, and then were married after three more. I mean, I was 29. And it's funny because at that point I told him, I'm just not going to finish my PhD. I'm in love. That's all I need. And he doesn't usually tell me what to do. But when he does, on the two occasions I can remember where he said, no, you will do that. It was really wise advice. He said, no, you've come too far. You must finish your PhD. So he was working as a lawyer. I finished my PhD, even though I was in love. And Twitter pated it, as I like to put it, because I went from being this totally rational Phi Beta Kappa 29-year-old, I thought sort of mature woman, to totally throwing it all over, saying, I just want to marry you, have babies, all that sort of thing. And so then we decided that we would go to America, and that he would get an MBA. And so I told him, hey, let me work and you get a degree. He had done that for me. And so I worked in a very, like, $14,000 a year job. Everybody in Austin's underemployed. He went to the University of Texas at Austin, and I worked for a Medicaid company as an insurance, on the phone insurance representative, handling ICD-9 codes for a year. And then somehow I worked out, they wanted me to be the director of communication. So I did editing and things like that and worked in the corporate world. It was actually for NHIC, which is Ross Perot's, was part of EDS, which was Ross Perot's company then. Because I had,
So did you ever think that you would get back to being an English professor?
Well,
question in your mind?
What was that a question in my mind? Would I ever get back to being an English professor? I had actually applied when we first got married to like work at Duke and places like that, and they only had adjunct positions that paid even less than, So we went with my husband's job. We've never been about one or the other. It's just like what works. We don't have a plan. We make it up as we go along. So I did wonder, and it was depressing in a way, but I tried to make the best of the situation because I wanted my husband to have this opportunity, and I was glad we were in America for him to learn about being a international student. And yeah, I did wonder. I mean, it was that aspect of it was, here I am with a PhD doing ICD-9 codes. It wasn't so much that it hurt my pride as it was confusing. You know, because I had tried to get publishing jobs at like University of Texas Press and different places and just couldn't. I mean, I did try. It wasn't that this was the first job. I mean, I had to. This was what worked out. And life is like that sometimes. So I tried to make the best of it. I made really good friends that I'm still friends with to this day. I learned about the non-academic world. That has, so when you talk about the twists and turns, that has helped me more than I can say as a teacher to understand something beyond the world of academics. And then we moved with my husband's job to Charlottesville, Virginia, and I found myself pregnant. And we always wanted, this was after 5 years of marriage, we always wanted somebody at home with the kids. So in spite of the fact that I was writing and doing some lecturing, I, you know, wanted to be the stay-at-home mom to take care of our daughter, Kate. So I always wrote. I always tried to publish. I always gave lectures, like to kindergarten kids, to on TV, if somebody asked at the TV. So, but it was always very...
So at this point, you weren't actually lecturing in English. You were still kind of teaching on the side a little bit and becoming a mother and kind of in a supportive role to your family. For the
part. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it wasn't about me. It was more like my insatiable curiosity and desire to learn, breaking out wherever it could. There was no plan. The plan was mostly, I call these my mommy, will you wipe me years? Because literally, literally, there was a period of 2 years or so where that was my, the demands that I met were, can I, you know, help my daughter get dressed, feed her, you know, shuttle her to her her classes, sit on playgrounds. And, you know, I'm really a list person, and I like to make good grades to help me get scholarships and stuff. But learning to sit on a playground and be content, which I did have to work at, and talk with people with whom I had nothing in common often, was to me also very helpful in learning to be a teacher, because it's not all about me. It's about the other person and what they have to say or you know.
So then how did you end up in the position where you are now? You've been a professor now for I'm not sure how many years, but how did you make that transition, and how did it feel to finally get that job that you had kind of been going for in your early 20s, and now, you know, you're older, you've had kids, you've gotten married, you've done the stay-at-home mom thing, and you've done the part-time or full-time job, you know, outside of the academy. How did you get back to the academy, and how did it feel to finally get there? Were you surprised?
Oh, I was definitely surprised, because my husband had the big job. He was director in a computer company, and then 9/11 happened, and his total job company disappeared. And he's a, you know, lawyer with MBA, and we were wondering, what do? We had just adopted our son John from Korea, and in spite of the fact that that was a huge joy, it was also a financial responsibility, and we just bought a house. So what do? We don't have a job. There are no jobs out there after 9/11. California went through a mini recession, if you remember about that time. And I called up an old professor friend of mine whose wife had died. I was just checking on him. I had no, this was not networking. This was my favorite professor, Wilson Hall, who was in grief. And he said to me, you know, our old English professor just went to University of Toronto to work on the old English project there. Would you be interested in applying? And I was like, I think we would. And so I talked it over with my husband. He said, well, I'll stay home. And so we swapped. we adjusted our budget. We were fortunate to be able to redo our house and sell it instead of going bankrupt in California, because you know a starter home in California is $650,000, and that was a scary time. But my husband put new windows in the house. When I asked him, how do you know how to do this, because he was sawing through the wall, he pointed at the book on the floor and said, I'm reading. And when the inspector came through, he said, you've done a great job. You know, so we literally made it up as we went along. So I started. Here's my take, though. I have to tell you, Sarah, you say, how was it when I started teaching? It was like much easier than being a stay-at-home mom. I mean, I thought to myself, not more fulfilling, not less fulfilling. It's all been fulfilling. See, I had to get to the point in my life where everything was fulfilling. Everything was a part of getting to know God better and learning to understand the Christ-like path, not my path, and trying to find the love in all of the twists and turns, and putting, you know, Christ first and my family, and also trying, also, I mean, let's not forget, me being a person, you know, trying to have a person and be fulfilled myself, but as part of a family, you know, that takes lots of juggling. I'm not sure I have that down pat even now. But my point is, I remember coming home and telling Sean, you have the harder job. He was a stay-at-home, learning to juggle, buying the groceries, changing the diapers for John, who was then one. I remember him saying to me once, I never knew I was going to be the one raising our son. And he said, I never knew how hard this was.
Wow.
And he's learned, he is awesome at it. But I'm more impressed with the fact that my husband became a very amazing stay-at-home dad, helped me with my website and all that kind of, was very supportive, than I am that I became a college professor. To me, he had the harder path.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Although you had the hard path for a long time. Lots of things. It's nice that you guys got to share that experience, although not at the same time. So I do want to ask you a little bit about your scholarship, because I think one thing that readers of The Well are interested in, I'm interested in too, although we study different time periods.
Yeah.
You're a medievalist and I think somewhat of a linguist. You're interested in etymology of words, things like that, translations. You have a recent book out on a translation of Alfric. So I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit, briefly, about your scholarship and how it relates to your faith, whether the two inform one another, you know, whether through content or theory, anything like that, how do they relate to one another?
Well, you're a great interviewer, because they do absolutely inform each other. And in fact, my career sort of grew out of my, in graduate school, having gone through a really hard period of insomnia and really dark time. And I started reading the Bible like the old monks and nuns do, although I didn't know at the time, with this Lectio Divina. And I started realizing I didn't know the Bible. Here I was, an English major. How embarrassing is that? And I didn't know this most famous and most wisest of all anthologies, the Bible. I knew it from sitting in a pew and hearing snippets of it, but I'd never studied it holistically. So I got out these expositors' Bible commentaries and just really started reading it through a couple of times, and then started, as Dr. Mary Kate Morse says, eating it. And I found that even though I wanted to do well and make A's, and I've always been a conscientious student, I found I couldn't study until I had to do my coursework, you know, on Tennyson or whatever, because you need to do it, until I had read the Bible for an hour or two a day and prayed. So my work is more like my soul's awareness. It's they're not two things. It grew out, my work actually sort of grew out of this period of Lectio Divina, and to this day I feel very fortunate. I mean, it's still work, because you know, you have to revise. I work with good editors like you and different people who require that you see that perhaps you could have done it differently. And so it's still work, but at the same time you're dealing with the word, with logos, and it's really, really sacramental to me that I want to have really high standards of scholarship, but at the same time it feeds my soul.
Wow.
Yep.
I mean, I would say that that's not true for every time period or for every kind of course of study that you can do in English. And I get jealous a little bit of the medievalists that I know, because they are studying, or the people who study Middle English, Piers Plowman, that kind of thing, because I think it's so cool to study something from an inside a time that was so informed by Christianity. I study 20th century. It's a little bit of some, it's a bit different than that, but but I can appreciate that ability, and I think, you know, where we end up is somewhere that God has led us.
Right.
However surprising and how many twists and turns there might be along the way. So I've enjoyed hearing your story. I wish we could talk all afternoon, and we'll probably keep chatting after I turn the tape recorder off. But for those of you listening who are readers as well, I hope you find encouragement in this, and I'm gonna let you have the last word. What encouragement do you have for readers of The Well and listeners? Yeah.
I would just say, take the opportunity to, whenever you can, study the Bible and have quiet times of prayer, even if it is in your car or before class, whenever. And one of the things I've always done is to say, dear God, please give me wisdom, because I really don't on my own have it. And Bishop Wright was saying that today. Don't forget to do the small things of, like, saying, hey, God, I need some help here. I really think it seems like a small thing for someone to do, and it's the largest thing of all. So I would say, invite God to help you, because I do this all the time, and I expect if when I'm 85, I will still be doing this. Dear God, please help me see the path ahead, because how else do we? You know? No, thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed listening and talking with you. All right, thanks.